Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Today, a reprise of a couple of interviews on policing in prisons first broadcast last August. In moments, the sociologist Alex Vitale will talk about the theory and practice of broken windows policing. And at the bottom of the hour, Naomi Morikawa will report on liberals' contribution to the building of the carceral state. Now on to Alex Vitale. Alex is a sociologist at Brooklyn College who specializes in the study of policing, especially the country's largest and most famous force, the NYPD. A good bit of Alex's work has involved studying broken windows policing, a theory that was first enunciated in a 1982 article in The Atlantic magazine by James Q. Wilson and George Kelling. As Alex describes in this interview, broken windows theory has led to a relentless policing pressure on poor neighborhoods that has had nothing to do with the drop in crime over the last 20 years, but has made many lives miserable. Bill de Blasio remains devoted to the strategy. Here's Alex Vitale. Before we talk broken windows, what about this business in Ferguson, Missouri? To someone, just a casual observer, it looks like the American police have collectively gone on a rampage of racist, trigger-happy murder. Is this impression correct? Is this old news? Something new happening? What is it? Put this in perspective for us.
Doug, you're always one for subtle language there. I'm not sure that we're seeing a change in policing. I think perhaps what we're seeing is a change in the reaction to the policing. And I wonder if perhaps the strong reaction to the Eric Garner case maybe has played a role in what's happening in Missouri. It's no way to know that for now. But look, the over-policing of communities of color is not a new story. Violence against young black men by the police is not a new story. We all know the long list of names. I think what's changed is both the level of reaction at the community level and the receptivity to this story by the media. So one could easily have imagined, you know, a small amount of violence in a small town in the Midwest in a community of color being largely ignored by the media or covered only momentarily. But I think that, and this may be in part because of the New York-centric nature of so much of the national media, that they're already immersed in this discourse around policing and communities of color and injustice that the Ferguson story, the Mike Brown story, has really taken on a larger life. But it's not a new story, but it is a very troubling story.
But, of course, really nothing all that new except the reaction to it. I mean, there's not been an increased level of willingness to shoot, according to the statistics?
No, in fact, in some ways, shootings are down. And I've been adding this little hashtag on Twitter, you know, there's nothing special about Ferguson. You know, there's nothing special about these cases, tragically. In the Eric Garner case here in New York, at least, what was special about it was just that it was caught on video, but that these are sort of daily interactions that people have with the police. We didn't have a video in the Ferguson case, but I think there's just a level of outrage is brewing.
Now, is there something in the way that cops are trained that makes them predisposed to this sort of thing? Is it just the kinds of people who are drawn to police work in the first place? How do you explain this as a sociologist?
I don't think that's generally true. It's certainly less true of big city departments. Now, we do have cases in small city departments, small town departments, where you do have people who are just straight up racist, over-aggressive, are associated with right-wing movements, paramilitaries, the KKK. I mean, all of that does sometimes happen in small communities. But I think it's more the nature of the job. We're asking the police to perform a job that is inherently unjust. And once you start going down that road of doing things like enforcing the war on drugs, engaging in this over-policing of minor offenses associated with the broken windows theory, once you go down that road, your attitude towards the public that you're being asked to police, mostly a poor and non-white community, becomes aggressive. And the way that you maintain control in those situations is constantly upping the level of aggression. So even the best-meaning, best-trained police officer is going to find themselves in a situation where they encounter an increasingly frustrated, hostile, and resisting public, and they're going to respond to that by upping the ante. And that's what we're seeing in a lot of these instances.
Now, there's been talk of, and I think even some experiments with having cops wear video cameras on their badges or whatever to record and discourage this sort of thing. What do you make of that?
I think it's probably a positive thing. The consent decree, the ruling in the stop and frisk case, the Floyd case here in New York, called for the creation of a pilot program for the use of cameras here in New York. The public advocate, Letitia James, just came out with a strong statement in support of moving ahead quickly with that. These police departments are able to get Humvees and drones and armored personnel carriers. I think they can figure out the cost and the data management for some lapel cameras. So there's no excuse for moving forward on this. As long as there are some protections on the data so that they're not using it to create gang databases and intelligence files on people, but that the data is only there to be reviewed when there's a specific criminal matter or a complaint about police conduct.
You mentioned some of the gadgets that the cops have gotten after 9/11, the war on terror, you know, the Humvees and the militarization of the police. Has that contributed anything to what seems like increased police violence?
The availability of military technology did not begin with 9/11. It was already well underway, and I've linked it, I think we discussed this once before, to the war on drugs and the development of SWAT teams, which is a product of the 70s and 80s, is when that the momentum begins to roll around that. And a lot of this militarizing mindset really has been directed at the war on drugs and this idea that, you know, there's this evil force in the society and that if we just bring ever greater force to bear on it, that somehow this will bring about good results. But it's really been one of the prime mechanisms for criminalizing young people, communities of color, poor people, and has seriously eroded the Fourth Amendment, has been used to justify this incredible ramp up in arming the police. And so I think even before 9/11, this was a major problem.
Okay, you mentioned broken windows, so let's now turn to that. First, give us the intellectual history of the broken windows theory. How did it come to be so prominently accepted?
Well, you know, it's a product of the neoconservative turn of the 70s. James Q. Wilson was a well-known criminologist, but associated with very conservative urban thinkers. He was a student of Edward Banfield, one of the most conservative urban thinkers of the 60s, whose book, The Unheavenly City, really says, well, we ought to just abandon the cities to the people who are not able to get out of there and just, you know, these people are all caught in a culture of poverty and anyone who has the means to leave, why on earth would you stay? And we should quit coddling these folks because any kind of social benefits we give them will just be squandered. You know, well, Wilson was Banfield's student at the University of Chicago. They were all pals with Milton Friedman. Banfield took Wilson with him to Harvard, and they co-wrote things together. You know, at least Wilson didn't believe in blowing up the cities. He, like a lot of urban neoconservatives, many of whom came out of progressive Jewish communities but became disheartened about the direction of cities in the wake of the civil rights movement and the social disorder that they associated with that. And basically, folks like Wilson and Fred Siegel, his now colleague, Kelling's colleague at the Manhattan Institute, said, look, liberal politicians gave blacks too much freedom, let them get away with too much, and that's why we have disorder, that's why we have crime, and what we need is to restore moral authority out on the streets. It's the counter narrative to saying, oh, well, what about deindustrialization, the abandonment of cities by the federal government? None of that gets discussed in this conservative narrative. So if you read fixing broken windows, Kelling's full book about the broken windows theory, he says, you know, where does the disorder problem come from? Oh, it's too much individualism. And what does he mean by that? He means the successes of the women's liberation movement, the civil rights movement, in freeing people and the sexual revolution, gay and lesbian rights, right? That unleashed too much individuality, and we have to clamp down on that in the name of communitarian kinds of values, which, of course, in his mind are white and middle-class values.
I mean, that's funny, given the association you mentioned with Milton Friedman, who was all about individualism, but I guess they're selective in their application of the doctrine.
Yeah, what they get from Milton Friedman, I think, is the idea that trying to use government to manipulate markets or provide a safety net is all just a wasted effort.
So broken windows itself associated zero tolerance policies. So what did that mean on the street?
Well, you know, in the original writing of it, the idea was supposed to be that the cop, the beat, who knew people in the neighborhood, would gently nudge people into behaving in a more civil fashion, not necessarily arresting them, working in partnership with other social actors to, you know, create a Jane Jacobs-like, you know, eyes on the street. But right from the beginning, in practice, what it meant was hyper-criminalization of poor people. So broken windows policing actually first gets underway in San Francisco as part of a backlash against homeless people, and it took the form of intensive ticketing and arresting of homeless people in public spaces. Its first application in New York that most people are aware of and has talked about is getting rid of squeegee men. How did they do that? Not by nudging them, not by providing social services, not by dealing with their problems, but by coming out and arresting them day after day after day, putting them in the criminal justice system. And so what it came to mean to police was criminalizing the problem through heavy police enforcement.
I'm speaking with Alex Vitale, a professor of sociology at Brooklyn College who studies police forces, especially the NYPD. Now, the apologists will say that by taking such a zero-tolerance policy, they prevented all kinds of crimes, and they take credit for the very sharp decline in the crime rate in New York and other major cities. They attribute it to this sort of policing philosophy. What do you say?
Well, I've said many times that you can use the broken windows theory to get rid of an isolated disorder problem like squeegee men. But don't try to tell me that that has anything to do with serious crime. Lots of research has been done. Bernard Harcourt has done some great work that shows that disorder and crime are not clearly linked. You can have disorderly places that don't have crime. You can get rid of disorder and still have crime problems. But more importantly, the crime drop is an international phenomenon that has taken place in cities all over the place, many of whom have never heard of broken windows policing. Many of them did not have a disorder problem to begin with. They had a crime problem. It's international in scope and can't possibly be connected in any meaningful way to changes that are specific to policing in New York City. The biggest sort of proponent or advocate of the role of policing in New York, Franklin Zimmering at Berkeley, said that maybe 20% of the crime drop in New York was specific to changes in policing. But even then, he said, those changes were not the changes connected to the broken windows theory. They had to do with hotspot policing and the use of CompStat. So even their biggest booster says it had nothing to do with broken windows theory.
And also, as I recall, the incarceration rate in New York did not zoom as much as it did in other places, right?
No, it actually came down at times during our giant crime drop. We know there's no correlation between incarceration rates and the crime drop. Canada has also had a very dramatic, long-trending crime drop, and they had absolutely no change in their long-standing low incarceration rates. They had no increase in the number of police, and they never really heard of broken windows policing up there.
So what has happened to the NYPD? We have now de Blasio in office a bit over 6 months. What's happened under his administration?
Well, I think what's going on is de Blasio does have some interesting progressive objectives. They're not radically transformative, but given the sort of direction of urban public policy over the last generation, I think they're significant. And my guess is his feeling, his advisor's feeling is that the one thing that could derail this agenda of trying to address some pretty significant inequalities would be an uptick in crime and disorder. So while they work on these inequality problems, they bring in Bratton to cover their right flank. You know, the problem is that the policing that Bratton is invested in conducting is reproducing exactly the inequalities that they claim they're trying to address. And so I think maybe they hoped they could kind of tread water on the policing thing while they deal with after-school stuff and pre-K and some changes to the minimum wage and some other very positive things. The problem is the policing is just so out of control, not in a new way, but just in an ongoing way that's been happening for a long time, that it's just, it doesn't look like it's going to be sustainable anymore.
What was Bratton's record like in L.A.?
He was seen, I think, as a very savvy political player who built alliances with important community figures, people of color, religious figures, etc., while at the same time, you know, engaging in the kind of over-policing that we associate with, like, stop and frisk and broken windows policing here in New York. And while there was blowback on the way he dealt with the situation in Skid Row, the way he handled, immigrant rights protests, he was able to mollify key opinion leaders sufficiently. So he had a kind of mixed record. He enjoyed the international trend of dropping crime. And, of course, every police leader, no matter what method of policing they're using, is trying to take credit for that crime drop.
Now, you said earlier that one of the reasons that de Blasio appointed Bratton was to cover his right flank, a political maneuver, but was there any policy intention behind it as well?
Well, I think in the sense that de Blasio understands that disorder does matter, and I agree, disorder matters. Having people living in parks and subways, having people making public spaces unusable through either serious crime or low-level criminal disorderly behavior, that's a problem. Anyone who wants to live in cities like myself should be concerned about that. And the public in New York has been so convinced by the sort of Giuliani media nexus that broken windows policing was the reason that we got rid of the disorder problems of the 80s and early 90s, that he's like, well, let's not let the disorder come back. So let's have Bratton stay on top of the disorder. So I think in that sense, it's not just a kind of cynical cover, but it is a feeling of, you know, well, we have to keep the disorder in check because we got more homeless people today than we had under Giuliani. We've got the same levels of youth unemployment. We got the same people not receiving adequate mental health or other kinds of health care. So the potential for a rebirth of widespread disorder is always looming out there.
Yeah, I was just up in Montreal, and I was struck by the visibility of poor and homeless people in public spaces in ways that we haven't seen in New York in 10 or 20 years. Where did all those folks go? I mean, the police just keep them out of public view?
Yeah, that's a big part of it. That's a big part of it. I mean, there was a rapid expansion of the population at Rikers Island, where it costs, you know, like $500 a night to keep someone. It's extremely expensive to run that place. And there was a real shifting of people to the outer boroughs, to more out-of-the-way spaces, getting people to go into the shelter system rather than sleeping rough outside was a part of it, and also preventing groups from forming. So if you go to Midtown Manhattan tonight, you'll see homeless people sleeping in boxes, wherever, but by themselves. And that was very different than in the late 80s, where people were setting up encampments. And somehow the encampment dynamic was much more disturbing to people, was much more of a sign of disorderliness, was much more visible than an individual who, after most people have gone home, you know, sets up a few boxes, sleeps, and then gets up at 6 in the morning.
Going forward, the Garner case, certainly out of the country when it, so I missed some of the coverage of it, but I mean, it obviously was major news. Is this going to change anything in the way the NYPD is run under de Blasio, or is it going to be business as more or less usual?
I don't think we know yet. They have tried to stay the course, you know, well, we're going to do some training. Training is not the issue here. As I said before, it's not like we can just do a kinder, gentler broken windows policing or a kinder, gentler, massive over-policing of young people's color. That's not going to cut it. Because really, what has been interesting about the Eric Garner case is the extent to which people are not just reacting to the death, but reacting to the underlying policy. My first thought when this happened was it's going to be all about the chokehold and it's going to be all about police brutality. And so, you know, I wrote a piece that appeared in the Daily News the next day trying to really drill down on the fact this is the result of a policy of over-policing in the guise of the broken windows theory, and that that's what has to be addressed.
Other police departments around the country, do they watch what the NYPD is up to? Is it an influential pace setter?
In some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. I mean, there's always the issue of New York exceptionalism. The size is so huge. The role of anti-terror stuff is so prominent. Not everyone could duplicate what we do in New York because they don't have the resources to throw at it. And I think, you know, what we're seeing going on in St. Louis is really a completely kind of analogous reaction, which is just that young people of color are tired of being over-policed. And so I think what police executives are doing this morning is looking at what's happening in Missouri as well and thinking about, you know, what is their relationship to these communities and what role is policing playing in exacerbating these problems.
That was Alex Vitale, who teaches sociology at Brooklyn College, from an interview first broadcast in August. His book on the NYPD, City of Disorder, was published by NYU Press in 2008. You can find him on Twitter under the handle avitale, A-V-I-T-A-L-E. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Home of the brave, land of the free. I don't want to be mistreated by no bourgeoisie, Lord, in a bourgeois town. It's a bourgeois town. I got the bourgeois blues, I'm gonna spread the news all around.
So the Bourgeois Blues by Leadbelly. Next up, Naomi Murakawa. She's an associate professor at the Center for African American Studies at Princeton. Her book, The First Civil Right, How Liberals Built Prison America, was published in August by Oxford University Press. Naomi Murakawa. The title and subtitle of your book make for an interesting paradox, because the first civil right, the title, is a quote from Richard Nixon, but then your subtitle is How Liberals Built Prison America, and I know Gary Wills once said that Nixon was the last liberal, but I don't think that's exactly what you mean by this. This phase of the story begins in the Truman years, really?
Yes. The first civil right is the right to safety. And the phrase the first civil right was, as you say, made famous through the 1968 presidential campaign when Richard Nixon traveled the country promising to restore law and order to a country that he thought was overrun with urban uprisings, mass protests, hippies, and rising crime. And, of course, the first civil right is...
Now, just a second. Can we separate those two things? Because on the one hand, we did have protests in the streets and urban riots. On the other hand, there was worry about street crime. Did those things get blended in the political imagination of the time, or were they separate?
I would say they were blended. They were deliberately blended as part of a political strategy to conflate Black civil rights with criminality. And this is what was so powerful and telling about Nixon's statement, the first civil right of every American is the right to be safe. Because when he said that in 1968, it was striking, of course, because this was not the first civil rights of the time. This was a moment following the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the 1965 Voting Rights Act, and the war in court expansion of rights of the accused. So when Nixon in 1968 stood up and said, the first civil right is the right to be safe, he was giving a racial message, which is implicitly the white right to safety comes first, and it cannot be threatened by these other special rights, rights of minorities, criminal rights, rights of prisoners. And that was the way he put the right.
This, of course, was a very conscious political strategy, although coded in its language.
Absolutely. So the reason I made the first civil right the title is that in some ways, beginning with that Nixon account, captures the conventional wisdom for how we understand mass incarceration in the United States. So the conventional explanation for why we have the world's largest prison system is that we have conservatives, in particular Republicans, who used crime politics to court white voters who were resentful about civil rights liberalization. This is the sort of conventional wisdom. And I chose the first civil right as the book's title because I wanted to begin with a really simple historical intervention. And that intervention is just to note that two decades before Nixon made the phrase the first civil right famous, two decades before that, liberal law and order campaigns pursued the right to safety as the first civil right, and they also called it a step towards racial equality. And the context I'm referencing is the 1947 report from Truman's Commission on Civil Rights. The context for that commission was that at the end of World War II, it was politically scandalous and internationally embarrassing for the United States that there were white mobs and white police officers working together in the brutalizing and lynching of African Americans, often veterans in uniform, in 1946. So from this moment, Truman's Committee on Civil Rights declared that the first civil right was the right to safety. And the way they defined it, this entailed right to safety from private and state violence, safety from violent white mobs, and safety from the so-called misbehavior of white cops, judges, and wardens. And it's from this moment through the present that I think we see the consistency of a particular law and order agenda, and that is an agenda to build a better carceral state, one that is layered with police professionalization, more procedures, more guidelines to minimize disparities in criminal sentencing. In short, the liberal law and order agenda is a project to build the bias out of the criminal justice system.
So what we needed was a fair criminal justice system, but there was no broader social critique than that.
Absolutely. It needed to be fair, and the way we would know it was fair is that it would be rule-based and rights-laden. It would have the language of Miranda rights, a full language of due process, ways to put forward administrative complaints for conditions of incarceration. And I think it's fair to say that in the policy battles, there are a number of policy planks that liberal Democrats lost. That is, they just lost certain fights, and that's how we got to where we are. But it's also fair to say that they did damage by winning certain things. And I think the most damaging thing that liberal law and order won is that they won an ideological fight that says the way we measure criminal justice is by evaluating the administrative quality by which individual is searched, arrested, warehoused, or put to death. And that is the wrong standard.
Yeah, the putting to death thing, as I was reading your book, I was thinking the way people obsess over the precise nature of how the death penalty is administered, and it just must be humanely administered. It's okay if you do it right, but you know, the ethical questions, philosophical questions about the death penalty itself get effaced in that discourse.
That's exactly right. And what is so telling about liberal Democrats, especially those through the Clinton administration, is that they simultaneously claim to provide some basics for a fair death penalty while they escalated the number of crimes punishable by death. And it's so clear that these two things go hand in hand. Right. That in the logic of how we justify warehousing and killing, the liberal language of having a rights laden process is that which simultaneously legitimizes more warehousing and more killing.
Now, let's go back to the 40s and 50s. The Myrtle report of Gunnar Myrtle's report, of course, was very important, very influential. How does that figure in your story?
I would say that that's the touchstone text of racial liberalism. The American Dilemma actually figures quite prominently in the 1947 Commission report on civil rights. It's remarkable that a lot of the lines from the American Dilemma are brought into the Commission report, but it's important to remember that Myrtle's understanding of prejudice was that it was something that existed in the heart of America, or really the heart of white America. So what we have happening in 1946 and 1947 is that we have murdered black people that then creates an impetus, a political impetus for this report. And then in the report, what needs to be preserved, what needs to be protected are not black lives per se, but what needs to be protected is a certain innocence of the American state, a certain way of cleansing the state of these little markers of racial prejudice. And what's so amazing to me about Myrdal and the way he's used in that report is that the report's only block quote from a scholar is actually from Myrdal. And that quote is the idea that we need to be afraid of racial discrimination because it actually engenders resentment in black people, and that this resentment can lead to acts of criminality. Now, what does that tell us? It tells us that the core concern for why we need to remedy racial discrimination is that if it goes unremedied, black people are going to engage in criminality and insurrection. That logic is at the heart of the liberal civil rights fight.
Yeah, it's a form of crowd control. You do also make the point that that the left, or liberal left, and the right shared a sense that there was something pathological about black people. They differed in the nature of the pathology, but there was something pathological, and we need to in the liberal version, be fairer and more transparent and incorporate more black folks into the process of criminal justice. The right wing answer is just more crackdown. More prisons, more cops. But this notion that there is something pathological about black people seemed shared across the political spectrum.
Yes, this is a form of liberal racial profiling. And that profile was always in agreement with conservatives that the default suspect for the crime problem are black people. The only difference between conservative and liberal takes on the crime problem, they agreed that it was a black crime problem. The only place they disagreed is what's happening in the black mind that we have that problem. Liberals were much more likely to have a kind of pity or cowering paternalism. They were more likely to acknowledge that the damage of white supremacy would have an impact, and that impact might come out as criminality. But let's just face it. When a white person is walking down the street, or a white taxi driver is considering picking someone up, if they look at a black person and presume it's a criminal, does it matter if that person's internal logic says, oh, I think that black person's a criminal because black people are just like that? Or if they say to themselves that black person's a criminal because they've had such a hard life? It doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter. And how black people are policed or treated and how they are criminalized in everyday life, the logic of the liberal racial profile is no better than the conservative racial profile.
And then if we move into the LBJ era, I should say I'm speaking with Naomi Murakawa, who's the author of The First Civil Right, How Liberals Built Prison America, just out from Oxford University Press. Okay, the LBJ era, of course, is remembered mostly as aside from the Vietnam War, as a period of domestic social progress, civil rights legislation, social welfare legislation. But the Johnson years also contributed to the carceral state. How'd that happen?
The two biggest federal crime laws that have been enacted in the 20th century were enacted during periods of unified democratic control. And the first was Johnson's Safe Street Act in 1968, and the second was Clinton's Omnibus Crime Act in 1994. So to start with Johnson, like many liberals of the time, believed that policing was a good and that it was a good that should be distributed to all people, and that it was the federal government's job to intervene to make sure that everyone got their policing in fair and equal proportion. Right? Liberals were also in a long-term struggle to help police to professionalize, and there were many proposals to have a transfer of federal funds to state and local police departments for the purposes of more training, more professionalization, more recruitment and retention of so-called minority police officers. And we see this sort of coming up through the 1961 U.S. Commission on Civil Rights report, which had huge recommendations that there should be criminal justice modernization with police professionalization at the heart of the recommendations. And you see a buildup for this kind of reform coming through the 1960s that really culminates with Johnson's signing of the Safe Streets Act. Now, the Safe Streets Act gave huge federal money to state law enforcement, and many of the liberals who voted for it did indeed say things like, black people need better policing, they need better police-community relationships. But the problem is, liberals could not write their own intentions into policy mandates. So what do we have? We have final legislation that's giving money to states instead of cities. The legislation prioritizes riot control and organized crime. So something that began with a proposal from the U.S. Civil Rights Commission saying we need fair, racially just policing actually became 1968 legislation that was a huge transfer of funds that states then used to buy helicopters, patrol cars, infrared cameras, riot gear. The LEAA, as it was authorized by President Johnson, financed Louisiana's purchase of a tank. Louisiana gave that tank to New Orleans police, who then used that tank to raid Black Panther headquarters in September of 1970.
Yes, so this so-called militarization of the police is a 40-some-year-old, more than 40-year-old phenomenon.
Yes, and when we talk about militarization of the police, it's important to underscore that it's not just about the technologies. It's not just about the tools. It's also about a shared understanding that the role of the police is to monitor people who are thought of as our internal enemies. Right?
Moving forward, Bill Clinton, certainly not a liberal in the sense that Johnson was, more of a neoliberal, and you know, certainly his DLC philosophy born out of a reaction against Great Society-ism. But nonetheless, I was shocked at some of your numbers on the severity of the laws that were passed during the Clinton years in the name of the Third Way. So we had, what, the Effective Death Penalty Act, which is one of the most ghoulish names for a piece of law I can imagine.
Yes, that's right. Clinton oversaw tremendous expansion of federal powers for policing. In some ways, though, I will say in the spirit of Johnson, there was also aims to reform policing and to make it look softer, look nicer around the edges. So the cornerstone of Clinton's Omnibus 1994 Crime Act was, of course, the COPS program, Community-Oriented Policing, which Clinton and his advisors said throughout was a philosophy, not a program. And in calling it such, they could have these gestures to little key phrases like involving the community and having police represent the communities in which they serve. But because it was just a philosophy and not a program, all the legislation did, once again, was transfer huge federal money to states and locals who then just used that to hire more police officers, who then, of course, performed policing by the norms of the day. And the norms of the day were not gently working with communities and listening to local leaders, the norms of the day were order maintenance policing, being on the ground, and arresting for everything. And that's what community policing became as Clinton subsidized it.
Yeah, well, that was roughly the time of the genesis of the Bratton model of a very intense focus on, you know, small offenses and massive deployment of force against certain neighborhoods.
Yes.
So, I mean, what's thought of as, you know, Rudy Giuliani and the right wing was, in fact, bipartisan.
Yeah, it was absolutely bipartisan. And, you know, Clinton's top domestic policy advisors saw this idea of adding 100,000 new police as a very natural, organic connection to Clinton's overall vision of reinventing big government. So in a really sort of sharp, ugly example of what some have called carceral neoliberalism, Clinton planned to fund the addition of cops and to fund state prison construction by swapping out money that was quote-unquote saved by cutting more than 250,000 federal employees from the payroll. And the idea was that government can do certain things well. It can do things like police and incarcerate quite well, but it can't do things like solve poverty. And so this was a remaking of big government that would still keep the scope of government big, and I would say far bigger and more coercive, but diminish that which the government is responsible for providing.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, like, Johnson at least had something like a social democratic agenda along with the repressive side, but Bill Clinton had, what, midnight basketball?
Yes, that's right. As many scholars have noted, Clinton not only turned his back on African Americans, Clinton made it a point, a spectacle, to discipline Black Americans, to show that this was a Democratic Party that knew how to be tough on crime and tough on African Americans. This is obvious in the way that he worked on the 1994 Crime Act, in which the Congressional Black Caucus was deeply opposed to the expansion of the death penalty. And Clinton turned his back on the Congressional Black Caucus and was willing to split with them, and indeed happy to split with them.
Let's now talk some about Ferguson. Many of the prescriptions in the wake of Ferguson, the president himself has been remarkably distant from these things, it seems, but many of the proposals that people are talking about are an extension of the things you talk about in the book and you've been talking about in this interview. You know, better policing, more training, more professionalization, more integration of police forces. Have we learned nothing in the last 50 years?
We've learned too little. I think we've learned too little because when we think about prison America, we tend to blame conservatives. And so we've pieced together the history in a certain way. And this is a history that does not include the liberal reforms to hire more Black police officers, to have more monitoring, to have more training, to incorporate the community. And there's a real problem when we excise this history. And the problem is, we don't understand that right now we have the same liberal proposals put forward with the same good intentions, and they're likely to reproduce the same monstrous outcomes. Those outcomes are going to be more policing, bigger policing, expanded state power, and predictably with the worst consequences for African Americans and people of color.
Now, of course, in Ferguson, you have a city that is two-thirds Black that is policed by, what, a 95% white police force. Would it have any effect to change that?
I think that when we're looking at police reform, we need to look at the totality of policing. And the totality of policing is that there is simply too much that is criminalized. So the evidence on whether or not Black police would do a better job, for example, is quite mixed. I would say a preponderance of the evidence is coming down on the side that police are going to arrest at rates that are comparable with the kind of arrest rates that are happening within their departments in any given place. That is a message of, we really shouldn't expect to see much change, right? The institution of policing works the way the institution of policing works. We can see what's happening in the news stories around Ferguson is that they tend to operate around this idea of figures, or the individual police officer, perhaps one good cop, one bad cop, right? And this is the way the story around Darren Wilson, white cop, versus the good cop who came in, Captain Ronald Johnson of Missouri Highway Patrol. Right? And the media story is sort of circling around these two individuals. The story of reform has nothing to do with individuals. Policing as an institution could not be made better by the idea that we can just keep selecting the same people and slot them into the same set of institutional power and expect different outcomes. What we tend to do is focus on who's making the arrests and the technicalities, the politeness by which officers are making arrests. And the fact is not about who's doing it or about the technicalities. The problem is the fact that so much is subject to arrest, that we tend to legislate almost all of our social problems by adding additional criminal laws. So every year, police make about 10 to 12 million arrests. Right? 10 to 12 million arrests. About 5% of those are for violent crimes. About, you know, another 10 to 12% are for property crimes. And then the rest, the vast majority, are for essentially misdemeanor offenses, non-traffic misdemeanor offenses that flood state courts, so that of these millions of arrests, you get about 500,000 a year for public drunkenness, you get another 500,000 for something that's called disorderly conduct, another 200,000 for vandalism, more still for violating loitering and curfewing arrests. In other words, the problem of policing is the fact that we have criminalization as a mode of governance, and then we tell police officers that it's their job to go out and enforce these criminal codes that are just full of hundreds of statutes and that grounds on which you can arrest almost anyone. And I think what we need to seriously consider when we're thinking about criminalization is we need to not just look at police and feel comfortable looking at them and saying, those are bad people doing a bad job. What we need to do is widen the lens and ask ourselves why it is that we criminalize so many acts. What does it mean that we keep loitering and public disorder and civil gang injunctions on the books when these statutes are so overbroad and so vague that we couldn't reasonably tell anyone it's their job to go out and enforce them? So I suspect that what's happening is that, you know, what a lot of people want is they want to go out and do their shopping downtown. And, you know, there may be a group of white teenagers sitting around with their shopping bags, sitting on the sidewalk, having a conversation. And perhaps next to them, there's, you know, a person in tattered clothes, maybe talking to himself or herself with his or her own shopping bags that may own, have everything they own in the world. And there is no criminal statute we could write that says, just arrest the undesirable one sitting on the sidewalk with the paper bags, right? We just have the general statute. And then we ask police to go out and make these decisions for us. And I think an honest grappling about criminalization and policing means that there's going to have to be a bigger conversation where we look at the criminal code and we ask ourselves why we think we have to have all of these things as subject to arrest.
Then to conclude on a very ambitious note, we're inserting police into a society, asking to keep order in a society that is profoundly polarized, getting more so all the time, geographically segregated, and a country with a history, incredible history of violence in general. These are really treated as, you know, legal and police problems when in fact they're profound problems of the whole arrangement of the political economy.
Yes, arrangements of the political economy, arrangements that are woven into the history and present day reality of white supremacy. And I would say that we need to exit from a standard of justice that is the liberal standard of justice. And that is a metric that asks us to evaluate criminal justice machinery by the procedural or administrative quality by which we arrest, warehouse, and put people to death. And instead of that, we need to move towards a metric of understanding how our criminal justice machinery produces and exacerbates group-differentiated vulnerability to premature death. This is Ruth Wilson Gilmore's standard for how we should understand racism, which is racism as the state-sanctioned and extra-legal production and exploitation of group-differentiated vulnerability to premature death. If that sounds like a long phrase, we could also just turn to the many young demonstrators and take seriously the value that Black life matters.
That was Naomi Murakawa, whose book The First Civil Right was published in August by Oxford University Press. This interview was also first broadcast in August. That's it for me, Doug Henwood, and Happy New Year to everyone. Let's go out with this, Police State by the UK Subs from 1983. Till next week, bye.